My name is Brendan. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be recovering from the disease of alcoholism today. And there's a reason we don't go to the same meetings. Plan it that way. No. My sobriety date is June 27, 1995. And sometimes I feel like I'm a newcomer, and I think that's good. Whenever I'm asked to speak, I haven't spoken that much, but the times I have, it's always a very humbling situation, you know. And I've heard in AA that you get right-sized. And, you know, I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, you know, and I definitely have that. I was born in Billings, Montana. Lived there for 3 years, moved to Texas, so I claim that I'm a Texan. Spent most of my life growing up in Texas. My dad was a Methodist minister. See the horns here? And I was a hyperactive child, and I was given Ritalin early on, so legal speed early on. And I had a lot of problems growing up. Socially, didn't fit in at school, grades weren't good, wouldn't listen to the teacher, short attention span, all this different stuff. And so, you know, sometimes the kids picked on me. You know, the teachers always having conferences with my parents about, you know, what's wrong with Brendan's mind and his brain. And when I was 10 years old, my mom decided to put me into sports. So I could sort of direct some of that hyperactivity. And she put me in the sport of gymnastics, and I took off like a bat out of hell. And that really has saved my ass up until getting sober, because it's the only thing that kept me on the straight and narrow. So I did gymnastics all through high school. Junior high school, when I was 11 years old, 7 years old actually, I had my first drink of alcohol, just because it was the wrong thing to do. And I knew it was against the rules, and that sort of excited me a little bit. So I grabbed a can of beer, and I snuck off into the bushes, and I drank a beer and stole some Lark cigarettes from my aunt. Smoked a few cigarettes by myself. Whew, you know. What does that mean? And I didn't drink, you know, until I was 11 again. 11, had the opportunity, sixth grade, you know, to, went to this party, and I don't know, the parents weren't there, and there was liquor, you know, like hard liquor and stuff. Wow, where'd they get this? And I tried it, and I liked it, and I got buzzed, and I liked that buzz. And the thing that I realized immediately, and I've heard over and over in the rooms, is that the discomfort that I usually carry with me, you know, feeling less than, the whole school thing, feeling stupid, feeling dumb, buying into that, first of all, you know, and believing it. All that stuff drifted off, and I was known as the wild man, you know, the partier, the guy that would do anything, you know. Went up through high school, kept partying, people would hand me, I don't care what it was, put it in my mouth and swallow it, smoke whatever, just drink, you know, whatever. And I just wanted to be wild and crazy, you know. So then people wouldn't really look and see who I really was, man. They just see that guy, Brendan, the crazy guy, the wild guy. And what I was really doing was hiding out, you know. I didn't, you know, if someone started to see who I really was, then they could always say, nah, he was just wasted, you know. He's not really like that. He was just trashed, you know. So coinciding with my early stages of alcoholism and drinking was this really successful athletic career, going through high school and being really successful in high school. I got recruited to several universities, which at the time, it was a lot of big shotism going on with that. Man, look at me, look at all the places I get to go and check out. I'm a recruit in NCAA, Division I, a lot of cool stuff. Not much gratitude. I chose the college. The criteria I used was how much of a party I had on the recruiting trip, not like what kind of educational programs they had. You know, none of that stuff. I didn't look into any of that stuff, man. I was just hoping that my test scores would get me into college, first of all. Because the coaches that were recruiting were a little bit worried about that. They were like, well, I'm going to have to do some work around that. But I ended up going to Southern Illinois University and did gymnastics there for 4 years. Had a really great career there, too, actually. But college is really where I started to take off with the drinking and other things, other mind-altering things. But primarily, drinking was always there. And I became a daily drinker in college. And I always claimed that it was a party, that it was partying, you know. My junior year in college was the very first inkling that I might have a problem. My dad sent me a little, I don't know if it was 10 or 20 questions, questionnaire, and I don't know if it was AA or something else, but it says, you know, if you answer whatever, 5 of these 10, 3 of these 20, I don't know what it was, you might be an alcoholic, so you might want to look at that. Well, me and my buddy sat there, and we just checked them all off, you know. Ever blacked out, ever not remember anything, ever miss work because of all these things, you know, and we just thought that was the funniest thing, you know. But really, deep down with that, there was a bell of truth that was ringing, and that sort of resonated, and it stayed with me like a stone inside my shoe, you know. So every once in a while, I'd notice it and I'd think about it and I wasn't real comfortable with it, but I just kept going. I left school without graduating, and I moved to Salt Lake City to train out there, and really went downhill out there. Really funky laws out there. You can't just buy alcohol there. You got to belong to a club. It's a state that run by the states. You got to belong to a club to go to a nightclub. You have to have a membership, you know. And I remember lying to get in. You know, I'd wear this USA jacket that I had, and I said, I'm on the Olympic team, and I'm here doing a, you know, whatever and whatever, and we'd like to get in. Oh yeah, it's the VIP. They'd take me in and do some stuff and lie to the girls. You know, the whole thing. It was just a lie. But I wanted to party, you know. I wanted to drink. And that's what I did. Salt Lake City became one of my worst nightmares. I had my first real just like solo binge, you know. I ended up living in this basement. Everybody that came out there ended up leaving. The whole thing fell through. I didn't have enough money to leave because I was putting my money other places. But I couldn't afford to even buy a tank of gas to leave. So I ended up living in this basement in Sandy, Utah, drinking every night and teaching kids during the day. That's a good mix. Youth of America. And that was so depressing, you know. I ended up putting, you know, sheets up on the windows. It was real dark in there. I didn't want any light because I was sleeping it off during the day. I'd get up at 2 or 3 and go to work and then get off at 9 and just drink it away. There was no one there that I knew. I couldn't get into the clubs anymore, you know. It sort of worn out the old the lies. And finally, I was able to scrap up enough money to move back. I moved back to Houston, Texas, and I started teaching again gymnastics. And this is where my pattern of drinking really, really kicked in. I started to go in this little bitty club called the Ginger Man in downtown Houston. And I see some people laughing. You might know that place. And there was this other place called Bitterman's. Well, I would work till 9. I'd get off. I'd go. I'd drink. I'd go home. After a while, after a year or so, I started to realize that it was just really, really starting to become a problem because it was starting to affect my personality with the kids. I was real short-tempered. I was lying. I was stealing stuff. Which is not the way I was raised. I didn't really want to do that stuff, but I was doing it, you know. And I really don't know why. I didn't need to steal. I didn't need to lie. I just started to do that stuff, you know. So I realized I was in trouble, and I was starting to drink on a daily basis, continue to drink on a daily basis, and I wanted to quit. And I got into this cycle where I would get off work, and I'd go to the bar, and I'd say, I'm going to have one. I'm just going to have one. And I'd have one, and I'd get there, and then I would say, F it. And then I would just go to oblivion, you know. And the next thing I know, I was falling off the stool, and it was 2 a.m. They were closing it up, or I was stumbling home, or I was waking up the next morning somewhere. And I'd get up, tremendous hangover, tremendous pain. The older I got, the more painful the hangovers got. You know, I couldn't shake them off anymore like I was when I was a kid. Really painful. I'd go in, do my job, and throughout the day I'd say, man, I am not going to drink tonight. I am not going to drink tonight. I am not going to drink tonight. I don't care what happens, I'm not going to drink tonight. And about 6, 7 o'clock at night, start feeling pretty good. I've been sweating all day, sweating it out of my system. And 9 o'clock roll around, I think I'm going to have one. And I got into this thing, man, where it was like that every night. We used to have these things called ice houses, little like convenience stores. They were from the old days when they actually where you went and bought your block of ice, but they were still in existence, you know, and you could go by there and get some really cheap beer, like 3 for $1, stuff like that, really cheap bottles of Lone Star and it's really shitty beer, but I'd go. And I'd get the 2 for $1 or 3 for $1, whatever it was, and I'd take them home or drink them there, stop by the ice house, take them home, and try and control it that way, you know, so 2 or 3 and then stop. And I couldn't do it, man. Then I had to go back out. I had to go back out and I had to go to the bar and get some. Or as my drinking progressed, I started going to the bar less and less, and I started to bring it home more and more for a couple reasons. One, it was a lot cheaper to buy, you know, and bring it home yourself and make your own drinks and drink your own beer. But the other thing was I was getting less social. And I didn't, you know, people were starting to get in my way of drinking. Here's a piece of the dishonesty that was real important in my step work that I had to address and I had to look at. I had moved to Indianapolis for a short stint and worked up there, and it wasn't working out for me, and so I decided to come back to Houston. Well, I started living with this girl, and you know, I was kind of like, well, I got this job offer back in Texas. This will be a nice escape route. You know, I'll just tell her, hey, I got to go back to Texas. Sorry, you know. And she gave me this, like, you know, oh my God, you didn't ask me to move to Texas with you. You hate me. You hate me. And I was like, I didn't really like her that much, you know. But I wasn't willing to be honest with her either. You know, I was like, all right, you can come. All right, come on. No big deal. You know, you can move all the way to Texas and live there with me. It's okay. And really what I was doing was I was using her because I knew my rent would be half as much. And I knew that, you know, she could do some cleaning and washing and all that stuff. I know I'm a pig. I know. Just do it. I'm just being honest. No tomatoes. And we got to the point. Our she was really, really, really trying to keep me from drinking because she saw me circling the drain, you know. And I was really fighting her about it, you know. And she, every night she'd be like, "Where were you?" You know, that whole thing. And she'd come into the bar, standing there. All right, let's go home. You know, everybody's like, "What the hell, man?" Really, really. She was just trying to help me out, really, just the best way she knew how, you know. Well, we finally, that relationship escalated to the point where we were standing out in the street screaming at each other, and she had a butcher knife. And so I thought, you know, I thought, well, maybe I should end this before we go any farther. That same girl, a couple of months earlier, before the butcher knife incident, we were driving by a place called the Men's Center in downtown Houston, and it was really for primarily for guys off the street or people who didn't have anywhere else to go that needed to address their alcoholism. And it was a little after 10 o'clock at night, and I told this girl I was with, I said, pull over, right here, because we were driving past it. She pulled over, and I got out, and I was thinking in my mind, I've had it, you know, I'm wasted. I was gonna hurt her. I was gonna break some things. It was really feeling, you know, violent, and I was tired of the drinking, tired of the alcoholic stuff. And I went up, banged on the door, and I saw a guy back in there in the men's center sweeping up, you know, and he just looked at me, like, "What do you want?" You know, and I'm like, "I'm here, man. I'm here. I'm ready to get sober. Come on." And the guy's just like, "Whatever." He was just sweeping up. I couldn't believe it, man. I was like, "Don't you know who I am, man? I'm ready to get sober now. You guys should be here for me, you know?" And that's really the way I thought. I was like, jackasses, I can't believe it, you know? So got back in the car, went home, and I tried to do some controlled drinking, and I was actually able to control it for a while, as far as I thought, you know? I thought I was controlling it. But what I was able to do was sweat out a couple of weeks without drinking, go through a little bit of physical stuff, not a whole lot. And then slowly and surely start controlling one drink at a time. And I'd have one drink and see, I knew it was, yeah. I mean, it was an issue, but I'm better now and I'm doing pretty good. And then it became two, and then it became, you know, just like we always hear in here, forget it. And then I was gone. And I got back in that cycle again where I'd go to work, get off at 9, go to the bar, wake up, swear that I'll never do it again. And I went through that cycle for another 2 years. I'm on every day, just like that. And I remember the breaking point. I woke up one morning in between the bathroom and my bedroom right there, was just passed out and puke, and I'm like, that's it. This is it, man. I cannot do this anymore. You know, I finally reached that place in my life where I had to keep drinking, but I couldn't drink anymore, you know, and it's a hell of a place to be, you know, it's just a hell of a place to be. And I opened the phone book, and I knew about AA because I had been 12-stepped a few years earlier by a gentleman. But I knew about AA, and so I asked them to tell me where the closest meeting was, and I ended up at a downtown Houston meeting called the Good Times Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where I say it saved my ass. AA saved my ass. I got sober in that group. And that group was a really cool group because it wasn't far from Enron, you know, the Crooked E. Yeah. And so this meeting, you'd have everybody from guys that were living on the street to these corporate Thai guys coming in from the big petrochemical downtown Houston. You know, these guys, newly sober, some of them, you know, coming in and listen to these guys. You know, they pull up in their Mercedes and stuff, and the guys on the street are telling them how to stay sober. It was a very interesting meeting, and then you had everybody in between, and it was just a really nice meeting, really diverse. But anyway, I got sober there, and it didn't come right away. I had to keep coming to that meeting, and I remember the first time I slipped, I was able to put together 2 days, I think, and I came back. Someone snickered over there. 2 days. And I came back, and I sat down, and at the end they gave out the chips, and they said, well, here's a white chip. You want a dry one for a wet one? You want to come up and get one, you know? And I was like, no way, man. I'm not gonna tell them. I screwed up. So I didn't tell anybody, you know? Shame, you know, all that stuff, you know? Get me back into that cycle. Shame, drinking. And I came back to the meeting, finally, and same thing happened, and I said, I gotta get honest and just tell some, you know, I gotta tell myself and just get up there and take another chip. So I did, and I got that chip, and that chip I got said, on the back of it said, to thine own self be true, man. That hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, it resonated with me unbelievably. So I got sober, and I got sober right before the July 4th, and I didn't think I'd make it through that. June 27th, I didn't have a sponsor, but I heard people in the room say, you know, there's going to be parties, 4th of July parties, this, and this club, here's a flyer, go to them, and I did, man. I just didn't think I could make it through July 4th. You know, how do you make it through those first times? How do you make it through Christmas? How do you make it through your birthday, 4th of July, whatever, you know, whatever those things are, those first times in your first few months of sobriety. But I did make it, and it's because I showed up at these clubs and I went to these barbecues, you know, and at these AA clubhouses, and I remember the low ceilings, man, and they were nicotine stained. You're still smoking back then, everybody, you know, and you walk in, it was like, oh. Which, I mean, I was smoking at the time too, I don't know why I'm bitching. But I just remember how stained it was, you know, and how thick the fog was in there. But everybody was in there staying sober, man, and eating. And I was there by myself, and I was real uncomfortable with it, you know. I didn't like being there, not knowing anybody. But I was willing, even that early on, in that first week, 10 days, whatever it was, to do what I had to do to stay sober. And it was shortly thereafter that I got a sponsor. In my third month of sobriety, I'd been working the steps with my sponsor, David, and he was a really good guy. He had just lost his wife to breast cancer, and he told me he was grateful that I came into his life, and it gave him something to do and get involved back into the program and sort of pull him out of where he was in the grieving process. In my third month of sobriety, He said, come over to my house, memorize the third step prayer. We're going to do the third step. I said, okay. And so I did that, studied the big book, read it, memorized it, went over to his house. He goes, okay, get on your knees. We got on our knees. Together we said the third step prayer. I got up and he said, okay, that's the third step. And I was like, well, that's it. Oh, the third step. Oopity-doo. Big deal, you know. I heard a lot about it in meetings, you know, how powerful it was and all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, I've done the third step now. The next day, I got a phone call from my doctor asking me to come in to the office. And I said, well, it sounds serious. And he said, yeah, it's serious. She said, yeah, it's serious. And I was like, wow, can you tell me what it is? She said, no, just come in. So I came into her office and we sat down across the table from the doctor and had that conversation you never want to have with your doctor, you know. Brendan, you have cancer. So I was like, oh, this is what I get for getting sober. You know, I've been a good boy. I've done what I'm supposed to do, and this is what's happening. I was floored. I couldn't believe it. I was in shock. So they didn't know what kind it was, so they had to wait till some results got back. The results came back. It turned out to be stage 4 incurable lymphoma. So now I'm like, okay, start planning the funeral, you know. So in my mind, I told my sponsor all this stuff. So in my mind, I started to plan out how I was going to reach oblivion and never come back, because I was scared, you know, as well I should have been. But I didn't have any tools at that point to deal with fear, you know. So I was thinking, I was lining up all these different ways and things and stocking up how I was just going to and never come back. And I wouldn't have to feel anything. I wouldn't have to worry anything, you know. No chemotherapy. I would just take care of it myself. And my sponsor called me up and he said, nah, you might be thinking about going out and drinking. And I was like, damn, how did he know? But he said, if you want to make it and you want to live, you're going to need every ounce of energy that you can get. And if you drink, you're not going to have it and you're not going to make it. So you need to make a decision right now what you're going to do. What are you going to do? And I'm like, okay, I'll go for it. I'll do whatever you say. And yeah, I got to beat this thing. So the first lesson, one of the first big lessons I got in AA was how to receive, because I didn't want to receive. Pride issues. Number one, I didn't want to get to know you all that well, you know, a bunch of you guys. I don't want you in my house and stuff. And so I started going through chemotherapy, and it was, you know, it's hard, and there's a lot of energy issues, and getting sick, and just a lot of issues around that, you know people who've been through it, there's people in here who've been through it, and it's hard, and so people started to rally around me, and wanted to take care of me, and do stuff for me, you know, and be of service, you know. I'm now involved in this service organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. There's people wanting to help me out, and so my sponsor, you know, taught me how to receive, you know. Just say thank you and let them do what they're supposed to do. And what he taught me was that, what I learned was that giving and receiving is circular. And if I do what I was taught when I was a little kid, it's better to give than it is to receive. If I live by that motto and I just give, then I'm denying someone of a gift, because receiving is a gift. It allows people to be of service. It allows people to get out of themselves. It allows people to feel good. You know, there was a lot of people around me feeling powerless. You know, they're not oncologists. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to treat me. They can't help the cancer piece. But they wanted to do something. They wanted to cook me meals. They wanted to wash my clothes. They wanted to vacuum my house. They wanted to paint my house. All this stuff. And I just had to let them. What I wanted to do was just crawl in a hole and just say, piss off, you know. But what I learned how to do was let them come into my home and say thank you and let them do what they needed to do. And it was a great thing. I mean, it helped me tremendously. You know, looking back at it, it saved me a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of energy that I could focus towards healing. I didn't know that at the time. So I went through 6 months of chemotherapy. Then I went through a year of alpha interferon. Some of you guys that have liver issues may know about alpha interferon. It sucks. It's terrible. But I did go through it. I achieved remission, and I was just coming out of it. Still sober, made it through. Sponsoring a guy, first sponsee, So into the program, you know, and grateful for it, you know, making it through. And I got a phone call from a friend in Orlando, Florida. He was an old college teammate. And he was doing stunt work out at Disney, and he said, "Hey, man, they're opening a new park here, and they're going to need some stunt guys. Do you want to, you know, come try it out?" And I was like, "Yeah, right, man. I'm like 30-something, and, you know, cancer, sick boy, you know. Self-talk was horrible back then, you know, affirming all kinds of negative crap. But I got off the phone. It was ridiculous. I'm not doing it." And my wife, Jana's like, "Well, why don't you just stay open to the fact that you might be able to do this?" And I was like, "Really?" She said, "Yeah." So she encouraged me to do it. So what I did was I chose to get back in shape, because my body had atrophied through the chemotherapy, a year and 18 months. You know, I was really skinny and didn't have any muscle tone or anything like that. And I decided to get back in shape and go out to Orlando and go to this audition, you know. And I decided, you know, what the heck, man? I'll just go to this audition. I'll try it. If I make it, great. If I don't, I've had a nice weekend in Orlando with my buddy, Bob. Wake up. He's falling asleep. And so I went out to Orlando, and I was back. I came back, was in Houston. Several weeks had passed. It was a Sunday night. It was like 9 or 10 at night. And someone had called me earlier that day and left a message on my machine. There was two messages on my machine, and I picked them up that night. And the first message was this guy saying, "Hey, this is Chris." He was an old student of mine, actually. He had grown up. He was a young man. And he says, "And I'm looking to buy this business. I want to buy your business. I had this mobile gymnastics school thing. And so I want to buy it off you." You know, just out of the blue. I hadn't advertised it or anything. I told anybody anything. So I'm like, wow, that was weird. The second message was Walt Disney World saying, "Hey, we want to talk to you about your future employment at Walt Disney World." And I was like, wow. So there's this alignment pointing towards Orlando, you know. And I had already started to nest and root in the community, the A community in Houston. And I was like, man, I'm not sure about this. But I thought about it, and I talked to my sponsor about it. And he says, "Man, take advantage of it. You know, you got an opportunity. Go for it. You're newly sober. You're healthy again. Do this thing, you know." So that's how I got to Orlando. And I did stunt work out of the Animal Kingdom in the Lion King show out there. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's a pretty cool show. It was a great job. I loved it. It's a young man's gig. I had to give it up at some point. It's just hard on the body. But I was performing in 2000, 2001. And I went in for tests, you know, my routine 6-month test, and blood work was bad. And so they looked, scans, everything had a cancer again in the liver. And so I had to stop the show, and I had to start treatment again. And the treatment wasn't working this time. And so it was like, oh, shit. You know, I got through that first round and thought if I ever got sick again, I used to do chemo again and make it. It's not working. What am I going to do? You know, so they ended up cutting my liver out, about a third of my liver. It's a pretty big tumor in there, I guess. And then chemo just wasn't working, so I became a candidate for a bone marrow transplant. So I went back to Houston, Texas, weird, huh, to MD Anderson for a bone marrow transplant, which was cool. So I go back to MD Anderson for the bone marrow transplant, which is a mile away from my original home group, the Good Times group. Freaking awesome, huh? And so I was able to go to a meeting at noon and go see my oncologist at 1, you know, 1:30, 2 o'clock, whatever it was. Man, it talk about grounding me before going in there. Because sobriety is cool, man. You know, and the steps are incredible. And I just got to tell you this story about resentments and the power of holding on to resentments. When I was an athlete in college, I was a big fish in high school, right, in a small pond, and got a lot of attention and stuff, and that was cool, and it was good for my pride, man. It helped it blow up, nice. But I got to college. I got to college and I was the small fish, you know. And there was this guy named Brian Babcock, pretty famous athlete. He was a really great gymnast. You know, he beat those guys maybe you've seen on TV. I mean, he was really great. Seen him in the magazines and everything. I walked into the gym. I remember the first time I saw him, and he was on rings doing this handstand. He's just like this specimen, this beast, you know, just incredible athlete. And I was like, wow, cool, man. Well, a year before, I had to go get my transplant. Coincidentally, he got this leukemia, and he living in Houston, coincidentally, and he ended up going to the transplant unit at MD Anderson. He got a transplant, he didn't make it, he passed. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, man, here's Brian Babcock. National champion. I don't know how many times All-American he was. This incredible guy, world championships, all this stuff. He didn't make it. How am I possibly going to make it? I'm not going to make it. This guy couldn't make it, you know? Here's the thing. Brian was always getting the media attention. He was on TV a lot. The papers were always coming in, giving him, you know, interviews and stuff. And I really, really didn't like that. I didn't tell anybody about it, but it was a resentment, you know. There was a lot of envy going on, jealousy, all that stuff. I never told anybody about this till years after. Held on to this the whole time. We were friends. I never mentioned it to him, never mentioned it to anybody. Holding on to this thing. I didn't even know it was there anymore. The week before I was going to go to Houston, I was walking into work at Disney. Out of Disney, they gave me an office job, which is really cool of them. And I stopped. I've done enough step work and emotional, spiritual stuff through the steps to know that there was something going on in here, and I wasn't willing to hang on to it anymore. And I just stopped. I was walking, and I stopped. And it was that same feeling that I used to get when I used to think about the envy and jealousy thing. And it was all blended in with all this fear of getting ready to go to Houston to this thing. And Brian was in my mind, and he didn't make it, and all this stuff. And I'm like, damn, I need to let go of this. I need to let go of this. And I said out loud, I just said, this doesn't serve me anymore. I no longer need this jealousy and envy that I've had for you. So I'm done with it. And just like you're hearing my voice, I heard Brian's voice go, Brendan, I'm going to guide you through this transplant. And I was like, whoa. I was like, wow. And the fear left, right? Not all of it, but I wasn't paralyzed, you know, anymore. And I think, you know, what I really believe now about the steps is here's a quote. It says, nature abhors a vacuum. And I think that when we do our work, when we do our steps, we move the shit out of our bodies, you know, emotionally, whatever it is that we were hanging on to, that we address in our steps, stuff that we're carrying with us, that weighs us down, that makes us want to numb out, that whatever it is. And I think when we do our steps and we do them, we move that stuff out, and I think there's room for something else to move into there. And I think that when our intentions are golden and they're spiritual, that I think God moves a place in, you know? And I think that's what happened to me that day. I became willing to make room for spirit, you know? And I know that's what happened that day. I went to Houston feeling a lot better about stuff. Did all my pre-work, all that stuff, calling people in the program, bringing meetings to my hospital room for my home group, all this stuff was cool. My buddy Gary, he was a musician. He came and played for me some songs, you know, and just a good AA buddy, you know. And I got up. It was time to do the transplant. I got up to the 11th floor, the transplant floor, and the first nurse that was working with me, just chit-chatting, getting to know each other, because we're going to get to know each other real well over the next couple months. And I said, you know, I had a friend who came through here a couple years ago. His name was Brian Biavar. Oh, yeah, I knew him. I was on his team. I was on his transplant team. I'm like, really? He's like, oh, yeah, man, he was awesome. And we talked, and I was just like, wow. Then I started thinking, you know, I could be in the bed that he was in, that Brian was in. And it turned out I had all these different people that worked with him worked, that knew him, remembered him, that were working on me, and they told me, they said, you know, this transplant you're doing right here, you're going to have a lot better shot at it than he did because of what he did. He did, you know, we learned a lot from his transplant. Every transplant that happens, we learned a lot from, and I was just like, wow, you know, and I'm thinking, man, I'm living in Orlando. How many people get transplants, you know? We get the same team, the same floor, 12, it was just bizarre, you know? But as you know, when you get sober, stuff like that happens. Synchronicity, man. It's not a surprise anymore. It's just cool. Am I right? Yeah. Yeah, it's just cool. Yeah. And so I made it through the transplant. You know, and it was one of the hardest things I've done in my life outside of getting sober. Another really cool thing that happened coincidentally was after I got out of the hospital, I had to stay in an apartment real close to the medical center there, and it was at a church. The church provides free apartments or very low rent apartments for patients while they have to stay there for long periods of time. Otherwise, it would break the bank, you know. So I think we were paying, I don't know, 10 bucks a day or something like that for this really nice two-bedroom, clean, safe apartment. And I shared a common wall with a church like fellowship hall or something. Meetings going on right there. 3 days a week. Meetings. AA meetings. I'm like, no way, man. So I'd go out the door and I'd shuffle because I was really weak. I mean, it was just, I was shuffling. I had to wear a mask and gloves. I walk into this AA meeting. Everybody's like, the alien. I just sat down and raised my hand. I'm a visitor. I'm an alcoholic. They're like, oh, whatever. Hey, Brendan, how's it going? But I couldn't believe the whole coincidence, synchronicity thing with sobriety and what was going on. Came back here, was convalescing, not working. 6 months after the transplant, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I was like, what? There's no way. There's no way this is happening, you know? And so Jana, my wife, who had been my caregiver, we flip-flop roles. And I got to be her caregiver. And I don't know which role is harder. You know, those of you who have been caregivers before, I don't know which role is harder. But I can tell you this, that whether she was in the caregiver role or the patient role or whatever role I was in, the tools that we learned in the program saved our ass. Prayer, fellowship, community support, people coming to our house again, cleaning, cooking, bringing meetings into the house, washing our car, cutting our grass, painting our house, replacing rotten wood on our house. The list goes on. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But I couldn't believe it, you know? I couldn't believe that we're going to have to go through this again. But we were willing to go through it. Again, we did. And she got well. And we both stayed sober through it. She continues to work Al-Anon. I continue to go to AA, go to some great meetings, have a great circle of friends in Orlando with AA. And 4 weeks ago, Jana relapsed with cancer. So we're dealing with it again. And she just had surgery, and she's going through treatment right now, too. But the thing, that, I tell you this long story, and I hope I'm not boring you, but I tell you this long story because what I've been able to do in AA is I've been able to see people get diagnosed with cancer and stay sober. And I've seen people die sober. I've seen people make it and stay sober. I've seen people get divorced and stay sober. I've seen people lose their job and stay sober. A friend of mine's daughter was kidnapped and killed in Houston. He stayed sober. He went crazy. He went crazy and he didn't drink. You know? He was crazy. But he didn't drink. And he's still way involved in AA now. You know? And his story is powerful because he didn't drink through that. And that's what I want to share with people is life sucks sometimes, man. And it is hard. And we all get the curveballs. Doesn't matter whether it comes in the form of cancer or whatever. It comes. And when it comes, we got to batten down the hatches and stay close to AA. share it, you know, like we're supposed to do with other people in recovery, share the fears, you know. What I want people to know is that I just want you to think that I work this incredible program and I have no fear and I'm just awesome and, you know, I walk through the fear and, you know, it's not, man. I'm scared right now. I'm scared, you know. I don't want to lose my wife and I don't want her to be in pain. That's, talk about powerlessness, man. Wow. When your family members are ill. Whew. Yeah. Third step prayer. Does that mean anything to me now? Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. And I'm reminded, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. And it blows me away. And the thing about death is that nobody gets left out. So we're all going. We're all going. And I'm not as worried about that today. I'm more worried about suffrage. You know, I don't want to suffer and I don't want people to suffer that I love. But even through suffrage, I've seen people make it and beautiful things happen in their last days even, you know, in the program especially. Something else I've learned is outside of AA, there's a lot that can happen for me and for people in the program. And I think my personal belief is that we were meant to expand. We have to stay close to the program and keep going to meetings so that I don't put it in my body, you know, the alcohol. And I need to help other people and I need to be there so when people show up, there's somebody there because that's what happened for me. And all that's crucial. And I found it so, I've had so many rich experiences outside of AA, but it's only because of AA that I've been able to find them, you know. And so there's just some wonderful things out in the world, you know, and being a good citizen. I mean, it sounds so simple, but it's a huge thing. It's a huge thing for us to be good citizens, you know. I'm not driving around drunk, threatening people's lives, you know. It's just so many things to being a good citizen, and I still have my issues, believe me, but I'm doing much better. I guess I've got a few more minutes to talk, huh? I really don't have a whole lot to add except that I'm still sober today. I continue to work the steps. I have a sponsor whose mom passed away 2 days ago, and I've watched people surround him and hold him up, you know, and pray for him and be there with him. And I was able to be at the hospital with him and his mom, you know, because AA has taught me to support people, you know. And when people die, we bury them and we do ritual, and AA is wonderful that way too. You know, but really, I'm done. I have nothing else to say. Thank you.
Love is eternal. That's something Brendan and Janet taught me. Shit. All right. It's 7:30.